House Labor and Commerce Committee. It's a work session on medical malpractice and liability bills that are before the committee. President is Representative Collins and Representative Donnelly, and we're talking to Mary Pierce of MICA. You'd mentioned that there was this other company, MIC, which is a doctor-owned company out of California.
Right.
And they do, you know how much they do? About what percentage of our market they got?
I think it's around 30% of the market.
Really? And then MICA does about 60?
A little less, 50. No, around 50.
And then it's that Minnesota company. Has,
well, CNA, which is a commercial company.
Yeah.
And CNA wrote in the state way before MICA was ever legislatively mandated. They never left the state, but they only write groups of physicians. They only write five or more physicians in a group. So their market or their underwritings are limited, and they always have been limited. Their market share hasn't changed very much over the years. They also happen to write, they have a dental program. They write dentists, medical malpractice in the state.
Hmm.
And they have most of the dentists.
And MICA doesn't do that?
No, MICA, you know, I wasn't here then, Representative Donnelly, but as I understand it, the task force that Governor Hammond appointed included dentists, and that was a consideration that dentists were supposed to be included under the provisions of MICA. But I don't know if they found that there was some availability of insurers to write dentist malpractice or exactly what happened, but that provision was never included in the MICA statute. So we were only mandated to write physicians, hospitals, and related health care.
So CNA's got about 10%, maybe
I think
a little more
than
10%.
Yeah, it's a fairly low percentage.
Yeah. And then the rest is there's a scad of admitted companies that have little tiny one or two policies or something.
There
right?
may be as much as another 5% medical malpractice is written under like group policies. For instance, the pathologists have a national group, the psychologists or psychiatrists have a national group that they can purchase insurance under, but it's a minimal amount of other carriers that are admitted.
Well, if your rates are coming down and MIC's rates are going up, are you getting people moving over to you?
I won't know that until we have our renewal on January 1st.
Because we asked that question of some people. I remember last year in the hearing, they came in and said our rates went up, and I said, well, MICA's rates haven't gone up for 2 years effectively, and they said, well, we got MIC, and I said, well, why don't you switch?
Coverage.
Yeah, most often that's why they don't make that switch. If they have any kind of long-term investment, MIC also has the free tail provision that we have, a similar type free tail provision. So if a physician has that investment and has been with them for a long time, they may choose to stay with them just to keep that tail coverage or the opportunity to have the free tail coverage. So that may be something. We do write nose coverage, so there is a possibility that they could move over to us with, there's a misunderstanding sometimes as to what that means, and basically what it means is that they could move over at the same maturity rate under the claims made policy and for no additional premium, but they just don't understand exactly how all of that works. So we've been in the process of trying to educate them through newsletters over a period of time and try to let them know what tail coverage really is, how the extending reporting endorsement works, and hopefully they'll understand a little bit more of what's available and what they can do and changes that they can make without penalty. And they've been aware of all.
Well, I'm really excited that your rates are going to... So you applied to the Division of Insurance requesting that your rates be reduced?
Yes.
Okay. And you said it was 5% for hospitals and 8% for doctors?
Yes.
That's exciting. That's great. Representative Collins?
To what elements would you attribute your ability to do that to reduce your rates?
considerations of factors that have been involved in us being able to reduce our rates. Number one, we're unique in that of all the medical malpractice carriers in the state, we're the only one that has an office and has local claim service in the state. We also have a highly qualified medical staff. I have 3 nurses working for me, and access to physicians both on our board and as policyholders. We are able to quickly judge liability, assess liability earlier than what normally happens in the insurance industry or may happen from somebody that's underwriting outside the state. We can make that assessment, and then what we're moving forward is on damages rather than moving forward trying to, you know, do a lot of very expensive investigation just to assess if there's any liability, if there truly is malpractice. And the other thing that, there's 2 other factors that I think. Number one, we have a very extensive risk management program, and including a participatory risk management program that is attached to our policy, and it's a contract, it becomes part of the contract. And what it does is it says that if there's 6 criteria, 3 of which are general cut criteria, that physicians, if they violate, can be immediately canceled by MICA. And one of the criteria, which I think is having is the third factor and having a very great effect on our business, is early incident reporting. And what we are doing is we are seeing a pattern where we've encouraged the physicians to provide us, under penalty, obviously, information on early incidents, and we are able to investigate those and wrap up the cases and, you know, assess liability very early on. And that's what that's done, is that's changed our payout pattern from about a 4-year to about a 2-year payout pattern. And as claims develop, there is a what we term a loss development factor. You know, inflation goes up, medical costs are rising, wages goes up, all those kinds of things. The longer a claim goes on, the more expensive the claim gets. So we've been able to really, I think, by diminishing that that payout time on a claim, I think that that has been also been a factor. So I'd say that those 3 have probably been the biggest factors in our increasing rate.
Probably the early reporting makes people pay attention in a sense to what they're doing, too.
Well, it also allows us to immediately help advise a physician if there is a risk management, what we see as a risk management problem. Mm-hmm. If there is something that the physician is doing, we know right away that there is a practice problem, perhaps. It may be a patient communication problem. It could be a lot of different types of problems. And we're able to talk to them about it and maybe do a, we do a office practice survey. We have various types of education that we can offer to the physician and hopefully, or the hospital. It just depends.
Do you feel that with the structure that you have now, that you have the adequate opportunity to identify physicians who are trouble physicians, so to speak?
Yes, we have a very well-developed underwriting guideline and interdepartmental procedures where if a physician has had 2 or more claims in the last 3 years, they're immediately triggered to go to our underwriting department, and then they have a whole series of questions that they start asking about that physician. Is there, and they look at all the occurrences the physician had, is it in and including all the claims that the physicians had, and see if there's some practice problem, if they're outside the normal scope, standard scope of medical practice, if they seem to be having a communication problem. Mm-hmm. And then we have the availability to surcharge that physician, cancel, non-renew, whatever. We also have a due process provided in that, mm-hmm. where oftentimes we'll bring in the physician and we may do some counseling. Mm-hmm. We had a particular very renowned surgeon in Anchorage where we found that there was a problem, and the problem was that he had the same problem that I do, he's a workaholic. Mm-hmm. And the more hours you put in, the more chances you have to have some incident occurring, not because he was, practiced bad medicine, only because he was overextended. And so we ended up counseling him and writing actually an endorsement attached to his policy that he had to do several things. One was take a vacation. His wife called. She was delighted with what we did. But he has personally thanked me and said that that kind of counseling ended up basically saving his marriage, saving his life, and saving his practice. And what I feel that we've done is continue to have a very competent surgeon that's maintained his practice in Anchorage and has not had a single incident since this endorsement was attached to his policy. And he kind of changed his lifestyle, I guess, for the best way to put it.
You mentioned that there were three sources where Alaska physicians can get insurance. In your estimation, what percentage of the physicians practicing in Alaska do not have insurance coverage?
Well, the Alaska State Medical Association is just doing a questionnaire which will be distributed to all physicians in the state. And they are we decided to do this based upon the information gathering that the Legislative Liability Task Force is doing. And the question came out as to what, in all professions, what percentage are uninsured. And that's always been a big question, so it was something that seemed logical to have answered. So there is a questionnaire going out. We're going to attempt to find out several bits of information. One of them has to do with the uninsured physician population. My guess has been 10 to 15%, and I can only guess at this particular moment of time, and that's based upon what I know to be the market share of the carriers. But I don't really have an idea. I think that the results of this survey, and it's supposed to be the results are supposed to be, as I understand it, available around the first part of January, should be ones that should help this committee and others make some pretty important decisions.
Do you have any comments, general comments, with regard to mandatory insurance for physicians and the mandatory insurance bill?
Well, it's a little hard for me as an executive director of an insurance company to refute mandatory insurance. Mm-hmm. I mean, premium dollars for Micah, so I can't exactly say. That is a question, and I think that it's one that is something that needs to be grappled with by the medical community. And certainly what we have done in the case, we're in a unique position because we insure hospitals as well as physicians, and oftentimes in a multiple defendant suit, there is an uninsured physician as part of that suit. We do have two uninsured hospitals in the state also, so it could go the other way. Mm-hmm. But our involvement has been one of trying to work something out financially with the uninsured physician. But in the past, of course, prior to the abolishment of joint and several liability, the insured physician or hospital has been the one that's paid the price for the uninsured physician.
One of the concerns that I have that if we mandated insurance for some of the specialties, it would make a real financial difference to them. And I think Ames suggested that perhaps MICA could become a high-risk pool or develop some mechanism for these people to be insured. Would that create any problems to you?
The idea of an assigned risk pool is usually one, as I understand, of the members being surcharged, not the opposite. In other words, there's not a subsidy. Mm-hmm. I think that Representative Donnelly's matching fund bill is, as I understand it, the concept behind that is some kind of a premium subsidy. One of the questions that the survey that ASMA is sending out asks has to do with insurance affordability to the physicians. if they want insurance, is it something that's affordable?
If you...
I don't understand.
I'd be interested. I know it's a really hard question, and I'm trying to think how to ask it, so it's not an impossible answer. The bill that we have says that if you have an outstanding judgment against you, you'd have to get $100,000 worth of insurance to continue to practice, right? And I was just wondering, can you give me a ballpark if somebody's, what's that costing now to physicians for, what do they buy in coverage now? Is it $1 million? Is it $500,000? And what's it costing people if they don't have anything versus, one? Or is it all rated individually for each one, so it's really hard for you to answer that?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to answer, but the lowest limits that we offer are $200,000, $600,000.
Okay.
Two-thirds of our physician population purchases limits of $500,000, $1 million.
Okay.
We offer as high as $1 million, $3 million limits. There are a few surgeons and anesthesiologists and certainly hospitals avail themselves of the $1 million, $3 million. But even most of our hospitals, since we do write basically the rural hospitals in the state of Alaska, most of those are at $500,000 limits.
Okay.
So
how much is it
cost? I can't really answer a cost of $100,000.
Okay, well, let's say for your $200,000, $600,000 policy, if I've got a perfect record as a physician, is there such a thing as a general practitioner?
Yes.
And what's it costing for them now?
At $200,000, $600,000, if they're a general practitioner or a family practitioner, and they're not doing obstetrics, which is, of course, a major question, I need to check, but I believe the first year rates are less than $400,000. And $4,000. Excuse me. I'll give you a real heart jump, right?
So you're saying it's $4,000?
Yeah, less than $4,000.
And if they go...
I can't remember what the fifth year rate is in that particular classification.
Does it go down with experience?
No, it goes up with experience.
The more years they're in practice?
The more years under claims made that you're in practice up to a maximum of 5 years, the premium increase, because you're increasing your exposure base.
Uh-huh.
You've had more years in practice, and therefore
more
years of exposure. So a first-year physician pays the least amount of money.
What's it? What happens after 5 years? What's that premium like?
Well, again, it would depend upon the classification, but if we're talking about family practitioners,
right,
with $200,000, $600,000, at the end of, don't quote me, but
yeah, sure.
It's $8,000 or less.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying to get a ballpark,
yeah,
whether it goes
somewhere
up to $50,000 a year or something.
No.
Okay. So it goes up a little bit each year. And then how much... I'm not holding you to these numbers. I just want to get an idea of what's going on here. When you get into obstetrics, how much more? Is that a separate premium in addition to this one?
It would fall into a different classification, Representative Donnelly. The fifth year rates for obstetrics at $500,000, $1 million, if I remember right, is right around $53,000.
Okay.
And that's the mature rate. So that'd be a doctor that had been practicing for 5 or more years.
How much did you say it was?
$53,000. And that's at $500,000, $1 million, and I don't remember what it's at $200,000, $600,000, but I don't think we have any OBs that are at less than $500,000, $1 million.
Yeah. So I'm a doctor, I'm in a small village, and I'm just a general, our family practitioner is the category, and somebody's having a baby, and I want to deliver the baby. But, there haven't been many deliveries, but I want to be insured for it. Would I have to buy the obstetrics policy before that occurrence to be covered?
If you're a family practitioner doing obstetrics, we have a lesser rate. There's a different classification that you fall under.
Okay.
And we also have a policy that no one has availed themselves of, but we tried to develop due to what we perceived as a obstetrical crisis a couple of years ago. And that is that the local rural family practitioner can choose to do the prenatal care and then have a collaborative agreement with a urban physician that will actually deliver the baby. Mm. And that is a really a lot less expensive rate for them to do that. What we were trying to do was allow make sure that the mother didn't have a high expense ticket of having to fly into an urban area to
get
prenatal care, but could have that with her local physician who she knew and was in the community.
Have you talked to doctors whether or not buying that?
Well, we specifically set it up because of a physician outcry, and I can't answer the question why they're
not buying it.
Why they're not buying it.
Is there some sort of sliding scale based on the number of the amount of activity in us obstetrics? I'm a doctor. I live in Cordova or some small town, and I only deliver 10 babies a year. How does my premium compare to somebody who's in Anchorage delivers 150 a year?
There is not a distinction between physicians performing a few deliveries as compared to performing a lot of deliveries. We look at that very carefully, and there seemed to be some question from the literature that we could read that if a doctor does, well, there's some cutoff. If you do too many, if you're delivering too many babies, then you're increasing your exposure.
Right.
If you're not delivering hardly any babies, then you're increasing your exposure because you're just not doing it.
You're not expertise at it as you would be if you were doing 70.
So there's some point in between, and very honestly, it's very difficult in the state of Alaska. We insure fewer than 300 doctors. Mike insures fewer than 300 doctors, and it's quite difficult for us to really further divide that up between, I'm not talking 300 doctors doing OB, I'm talking 300 doctors total.
Yeah.
I don't know the number of doctors we have that are delivering babies.
We see that's the problem, and I really applaud your effort on this prenatal policy. That's a great idea, I think. I'd be really interested if you could find out from your folks why they're not taking advantage of it, if there's something why that isn't working. It'd be really useful to us.
I have some questions along that line with regard to collaborative agreements. What kinds of protections are in that collaborative agreement for the person who's delivering the baby? Because we've had a lot of testimony in other committee hearings on other issues, particularly issues relevant to child care and child development, and the need for proper prenatal care and the high degree of complications, birth defects, all those things that occur if someone doesn't have good prenatal care. And so I guess the concern that I would have if I were an OBGYN guy delivering the baby, I'd want to know that there was some kind of protection for me if the guy who was doing the prenatal stuff didn't do it right or didn't monitor the patient, and I wind up delivering a baby who's got some neurological problem. What kind of, I can see why they wouldn't buy it because I wouldn't do it either. But so my question to you is, what kind of protection is in that collaborative agreement for the OBGYN guy to encourage him to, accept the risk of taking on this patient where somebody else has given the prenatal care?
Representative Collins, we had established guidelines, and the guidelines were based upon American Medical Association national guidelines on obstetrical care, high-risk, pregnancy frequencies, visits, what you have to test for. One of the things that I'm very excited about is something that we introduced to the state very recently, and that is a prenatal system, which we have fought for and given to all of our physicians that are doing OB, delivering babies. And it is a system with a checklist that says this is what you do when. And we've also offered it at a discounted rate to the physicians in the state that are not our insurance. And the public health system has talked to us about it, and they've bought into it. So it's almost becoming a statewide system, which should decrease the frequency or the incident of bad baby by a lot. It has been working in Colorado. They've had it for they've had the system instituted in Colorado for I think what's been 33 months. They have not had a single claim.
I guess what you're saying
is 33 months. So it's a type of system that I think allows for you not to let something slip through the cracks, and certainly would it's similar to what we had in guidelines prior to that, so that the collaborative physician, the physician that's getting the mother, the unknown mother to them in Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau, isn't accepting something that they feel has not received correct prenatal care.
So I guess what you're saying is that through the utilization of that system, what you're actually doing is establishing a standard.
Yes.
And that the protection for the physician lies in the standard of
has
been established by the
On the single rate, the $53,000 rate for a 5-year person delivering babies, that's something I'm real concerned about. I'd like to find a way to either subsidize or to schedule out the cost of that policy to people who are in smaller areas, doctors who are rural doctors. So because it seemed like we got a lot of testimony, got a lot of letters last year from folks that said that policy just is prohibitive for them, and they've just stopped doing deliveries because they only do 3 or 4 deliveries a year.
Representative Donnelly, I want to tell you that is the obstetrician's rates, okay?
Uh-huh.
So we, as far as I know, do not have any obstetricians in rural areas. They are family practitioners doing obstetrics, and that is a lesser rate, and I can't quote you that rate.
Okay, well, see, that's what I'm trying to get at. I need
right.
to understand.
I'm sorry, I want to make myself very clear.
Good, okay, so this is the rate for people who, that's their profession, that's what they do, is deliver babies.
Right, that's their specialty.
I'd be real interested in knowing what the rate is for family practitioners who want to deliver babies also when it comes up. On a limited basis, it in their full-time practice. And
I'll make sure that the committee gets a copy of our rate sheet.
Good. And that's the most important thing to me right now, because that was, I think, of all the complaints, it's the one that really, really worried me the most. There were several, a lot of things worried me, but that was the one that really worried me, was that people were saying, well, I'm just going to refuse to deliver babies because I can't afford the extra premium to be allowed to do that. You can't, shoot for a ballpark figure. Is it another 10, 20, 30?
I really would rather not do
okay.
that, because available
now,
and can get over to you really
do
quick.
You know that within that additional rate, I'm a family practitioner in Bethel, and I want to deliver a few babies. Within that rate, is it that extension of the, I pay the family practitioner rate, and then there's an optional more money I can pay if I want to make deliveries. Within that, is there any sliding scale for the number of babies that I'd want to pay, or is it just a flat fee additional for everybody?
There is no sliding scale.
Okay. I'd be really interested in working with you and figuring out if there's some way we can achieve that. If there's not some way to achieve that, then I'm really interested in fine-tuning the subsidy ideas we've had to address something like that. If it doesn't work for you from an insurance matter, maybe we can subsidize that rates from a different point of view, different angles, so it doesn't totally foul up your insurance works. But we can also address the public policy considerations of we'd like them to have the flexibility to do these deliveries in those areas.
Yes, we're always willing to work with you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lehman, if I can interject right here. While the idea is fresh in my mind, this is one of the challenges that I know a number of engineers and architects are having. It's about this, I think, the same policy with their insurance. If you do an hour's worth of work or a full year's worth of work, you have to pay the insurance premium up front for a certain amount of coverage. And so those who are, and I was talking about this,
so therefore I choose to go without. And it, I see the same thing happening here. And so we're, we have a system that that hurts the small time to small business. And, you know, I think it's something we need to look at in the medical profession as well as other professions and see what we can do, if there's anything we can do to be aiding them. I have a question of Mary, if I could continue. You say that you don't have any rural obstetricians covered, and maybe they don't exist, or at least none of the micro program. I don't, do they exist under the federal government and the native hospitals in Bethel, or not necessarily, or do you know?
The public health system, which is extensive in the state of Alaska, is something I'm not that familiar with and would really not, rather not comment on. The Alaska State Medical Association does publish by specialty, and I think it's also by election district, all the physicians in the state, what specialty they perform by election district. So you might be able to get a better representation of who might be doing obstetrics. I believe that most people that are obstetricians are working in an area where they can deliver a lot of babies, because that's what they do. So they're in the urban areas rather than rural areas.
Are we talking about a dozen doctors in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Juneau, something like that, obstetricians?
I think there are, again, this is off the top of my head, I think there are 13 obstetricians in Anchorage.
And are they all covered under MICA? Do you have all 13?
We lost four obstetricians in Anchorage last year who went uninsured.
Okay, and they probably would have been in this $53,000 category, I would assume. Probably most of them are well-seasoned by now.
Yes, representative.
Do you know what the approximate number of deliveries they have, the average one? And are we looking at 150? I don't know what the right numbers are. It seems to me like, I know when my wife delivered that the doctor was call as soon to another one. I mean, he was catching babies, two and three a day. I thought, well, that's pretty good deal he has going here. But I'm trying to figure out, you know, how that $53,000 is spread over how many deliveries on average. You know, is it $300 of insurance per delivery out of the total amount, or is it 1,000?
I think that would depend upon the individual's physician's practice. So
right.
I know that, but
does anybody know? Are we talking about approximately 150 average, or
could
is that
you
high?
Try to find out for us?
I mean,
we don't, the medical board doesn't license by specialty. So when I have a specialty question, I go to the medical association's directory that lists them by specialty and by location. It would be possible, I would expect, maybe for the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, the Alaska chapter, to provide some of that information. The hospitals would have delivery statistics. So I'm sure the numbers are available.
Well, yeah, we could probably take the number of deliveries total in Anchorage, and, you know, there's a certain number of home deliveries, and through the Public Health Service, through the military, maybe split those out and divide by the number of doctors remaining. That may be a way to do it.
Representative Lehman, we do have that information on our application. So I can look at the insured obstetricians that we have and tell you how many babies they say they deliver on estimated annual basis.
It's more of curiosity. I'm trying to figure out how much of a problem this is for the high rate of delivery once. You know, when you're talking about those who deliver low amounts and increasing the risk, it reminded me, if I could digress just for a second, of human interest, at least of interest to me. My grandmother delivered 50 babies as a midwife over a 20-year time span, approximately 20 years, what we could determine in interviews with her before she died. And so that would be about 2 to 3 a year And I might note that she didn't lose one of them in an area where there were no doctors. I assume there was no prenatal care. There's a good chance that for some of them, there may have been incidences of alcohol drinking, so which when the mother would increase the chances for problems. And she probably was in the high risk category. And I find that to be amazing. You know, now we have so many cesarean deliveries, and in her case, obviously she didn't deliver one of them that way. So, kind of interesting. That was here in Alaska.
I think Representative Lehman, the other thing that's happened is that we have to perform now under the standards of care of the moment, and where in years past the standard of care may have been different. I think it's commendable that you never lost anybody.
I'm not suggesting that we return to that, and I'm sure. Well, even when my mother was pregnant, she didn't deliver my mother's babies. My mother flew to Seward and was, you know, she would fly early. Your comment about those from rural areas coming in, and she would go 2 or 3 weeks before she was scheduled to deliver, and would just sit and wait, essentially. And so even by the time, you know, when my generation was born, it was different. But you know, we're talking about before that, where there was no road system. Air travel was extremely limited. It was Joe Merrill or whoever, and Howard Romig, I think, was, you know, those were the ones that were flying the skies around the South Central Alaska at that time. So, anyway.
Well, we'd like to understand the problem better, and that was one of the main purposes of the subsidy bill, was to try to address that. If we can't do it within the insurance structure efficiently, maybe we can do it through some other type of mechanisms. I'd like to find some answers to that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
I guess, to me, that would kind of be somewhat incomplete information, although I'll be happy to see it, but in terms of the committee drawing conclusions, if you take, you know, I'll say an obstetrician, and he delivers 50 babies, and he charges $3,000, I don't know what the going rate is, $5,000 per baby. You multiply the number of babies he's delivered by the amount of money he's charged for each baby, you're going to get an amount, and you're going to say, well, $53,000, if you look at that full amount, you might think, and it might appear that $53,000 is not a lot of money, but I think it's important to keep it in perspective with regard to the fact that that is not the only expense that a person pays. I mean, like in my business, I pay a malpractice premium too, and, you know, insurance. And if someone looked at the amount of premium that I pay as opposed to, you know, the money the company generates, they'd say, well, that's really not a lot of money. But the problem is that there are a lot of other costs associated with maintaining that volume and that level of business that it's more than just the $53,000, because if you're going to deliver 100 babies as opposed to delivering 5 babies, you're going to have more equipment, you're going to have more staff, you're going to have more stuff. So I think if you're looking at just the number of babies that a doctor delivers and compares that to the amount of his premium, you're not going to get a fair idea of what the actual cost of delivery per child is.
Yeah, I've seen in other states they've gone through this process of doing analysis. And some of the other states that have subsidy programs have a percentage of their of the.
There is a 3-page document that we got right at the end of our meeting yesterday. I think that I've got it into your file, or I'll make other copies. It's from House Research, and it talks about the 4 other states that have subsidy programs. It doesn't explain them in. All of these subsidy programs are basically a flat fee. They're not set up on a sliding scale. It's interesting to note, and when they describe the oldest one, which is in Hawaii, it's extremely informal. It has nothing to do, you don't have to be handling indigent patients. You do not have to live in a, or you don't have to have so many births per year. They will provide a subsidy of up to $30,000 of the amount of your malpractice fee that is associated with child delivery. And the program's been in effect for 4 years, and it's very informal, it's very easy to comply with, it's very lucrative, and they have less than 7 physicians participating. I don't know any more about it than what's read here. I was just noting that when you were talking about having a program under MICA where you can have a substantially reduced premium if you enter into a collaborative relationship, you don't have anybody taking advantage of that. Here we have a program in Hawaii that will basically subsidize up to the entire amount of your premium, and they have very few physicians that are participating. I don't know why.
Can you give them a call?
I certainly will. Okay. But I can say that as they're described here, there aren't any, all of them are basically on a, they all are for obstetrical care, and they're in rural areas, and there's either there's a flat fee that you're entitled to based on either the number of deliveries in the area or the number of deliveries that you do. The sliding scale that's set up under House Bill 350 would provide matching funds for urban physicians who are delivering babies if the amount of income they get for those services is depending on the proportion of the amount of income and the amount that they have to pay in premium. I mean, one of the advantages perhaps to the sliding scale is that it will target those physicians who are maybe not delivering so many babies but are having to pay they don't receive that much income from their services, but they are having to pay a high premium.
Yeah. I want to ask a question.
Yeah.
Is there any allowance in there for midwives, any medical coverage, malpractice coverage for midwives in rural areas?
No, except you guys medical.
It's just physicians.
Ma'am, your name's Erica Mahoney, right? Okay, I just needed to say that for the record. No, it hasn't been considered. I've never talked about it. Okay, are there any further questions of Ms. Pierce?
I have one of Ginger. Is it this intentionally a 3-page memo, that, or are there more pages? It appears that my last page continues on, but maybe it's on a topic
I believe
unrelated.
That if you check the page numbers at the top, the copy I have is page 1, and then page 3, and then page 2.
I just
noticed
that.
Is. So we got this in a hurry. There were also backup documentation that came, but wasn't fully faxed. So we'll get that, a hard copy today. Perhaps I'll get it into your files.
Okay.
Mary, I've learned a lot today. I'm really glad you could be here today. Does anybody else have any other questions? Did you have any questions?
The only other thing, sir, is that when you were discussing the claims made and occurrence policies, and I don't know what the history was either in Alaska adopting added a statute, but I do believe that the question of claims made versus occurrence policies is a major element of the Attorney General's lawsuit. In the insurance industry case, and the accusation being that there was some conspiracy on the part of the insurance industry to refuse to write occurrence-based policies any longer. That there was a conspiracy on the part of reinsurers, I believe, as part of the accusation in the lawsuits.
Mary, how hard would it be to go back to occurrences?
There is a difficulty only in the fact that what we would have to do is generate our rates based upon an occurrence policy contract, and that would be something we would have to give to our actuary to develop all of our experience based upon the idea that we were not going to be writing claims made, but rather be writing occurrence. So that would generate new rates. The other major problem in occurrence policies is, and I think that really Ginger mentioned this, there are no reinsurers writing excess insurance on an occurrence form. So they only write on claims made form. So it would basically kill our.
Oh, why don't you have a seat at the end of the table?
You want to sit here?
No, just sit here. I like long tables.
Well, yeah, but okay.
Would you rather?
Yeah, why don't you? Because then people can look down at the table at you rather than have to sit on top of it.
Oh, can move.
You
can look either way.
Representative Donnelly, members of the committee, I'm Sherry Kochman. I work for the governor, and I am here to explain to you House Bill 345, which has a companion bill in the Senate Bill 323. We call it the Med-Mal Bill. It's trying to propose a new approach to answer the problem we have with medical malpractice insurance. There's a few things before explaining the bill itself that I want to make clear about what the governor's intent is here, even if it's not, if we have not succeeded in that intent in the bill. The overall first concern of the governor was to lower the cost of the system. And by the system, I mean both to the injured parties and to the doctors, that includes insurance rates. That was probably the primary focus of this bill and the reason for this bill. Equal with that, no less than that, is an attempt to get the money into the pockets of the injured, not into the pockets of insurance companies, not into the pockets of the attorneys, the providers, whomever. It was to get the money to the injured parties and as quickly and timely as possible. Thirdly, and this was brought up, you have alluded to this, Representative Donnelly, the governor's overall concern for the status of health care in Alaska. We're seeing more and more hospitals go bare, more and more doctors go bare. Florida, a couple years ago, issued a report on the plight of the rural hospital. It's pretty frightening what's happening with rural hospitals throughout the country, and we're seeing it starting to happen here. And we have a fear, and why should you live in a village of 2,000 people, or a town, a small town of 2,000 people, not be able to deliver your baby in that town? So that's, I'd say those three concerns are the three-pronged approach to why this bill even happened. The governor will admit up front, he did it in his transmittal letter, that this is far from perfect. He sat down one day on a yellow pad one night and jotted out the general concept for this bill and handed it to me, who handed it to Kristen and Beth Curtula and said, here, try to fix this, and we haven't finished fixing it. It's not perfect. It needs work. I'll discuss with you where the holes are that we see and what we plan to try to do with those. Enough said on all the introduction. The way the bill itself works is, first of all, it is intended to be an exclusive remedy. In settling a medical malpractice case, this is the route you go, as opposed to going right to court. So this is the exclusive remedy. The reason for that is we're trying to urge, in any way possible, prompt settlement of a medical malpractice claim, and keeping it out of the court system, keeping litigation down, because that will make it come to settlement quicker, and it will keep the costs out of the system, hopefully. What this bill does is establish what we call the Alaska Healthcare Claims Board. We have very much modeled it after the workers' comp system, which I know you're very familiar with. We use the term no fault, similar to workers' comp, in describing this system, in that the issue here is not trying to place fault on a physician, place fault on an injured. There are some exceptions, which I'll get into. But we are just saying there is a person who is injured for some reason as a result of a medical procedure, presumably, and this person is or is not due compensation for the injury. That's what you're deciding. You're not trying to place was the fault on the doctor's part or on the injured's part in most cases. There are going to be some exceptions to that. The board itself is comprised of five people. One would be an attorney, one would be somebody in the medical profession, the other three would be totally uninvolved with either the attorney, legal profession, or the medical profession. As most new boards are set up, there's a compensation system, a per diem system, all the standard stuff. It's located in the Department of Commerce, just because there's really no other place to put it. But it would be a pseudo-separate entity under the Department of Commerce and Economic Development, just so it's got some kind of agency to work through. But it would really be semi-autonomous in the way that it would operate, similar to some other boards that we have. The statute clearly states that the board's rules and regulations must be simple, must be easily understood. The way that claims are filed must be simple, so that we enhance a person's ability to do it on their own without hiring an attorney for assistance. Now, the way it actually works is, say, I get injured, believe I was injured as a result of a medical procedure. I file a claim with the claims board. Send a copy of that claim to my provider, whoever that was. The board considers, first, while that's happening, I can also go directly, or the physician or the provider come directly to me and try to settle. And there are mechanisms that we've built into the bill that are trying to urge that settlement before it even goes through a hearing process. If the provider and the claimant do settle, they take that settlement to the claims board, which must approve it and say, yes, this is okay based on this statute. This falls under the guidelines of the statutory settlement structure we've set up here. So yes, the settlement's fine, and bye-bye, you're on your way, just pay the person. If the provider denies settlement, then it goes to the board, who can choose to investigate and who can choose to hold a hearing. One thing that I know at the liability task force meeting, there was some concern. There is the ability then for that decision of the board to be appealed. Of course, you still can't end up in Superior Court and appeal it. So that route is still available. Once the board decides that there is a legitimate claim here and there is compensation is due, the compensation itself is very structured. We've broken down into three basic categories. Temporary impairment, something that happened that temporarily put you out of work, made you incapacitated, but you're going to get healthy again, you're going to be fine again. And this is somewhat shadows workers' comp as well. Permanent impairment, there's something happened to you that will always be a problem for you. And then, of course, death. The way each is compensated, the temporary impairment, all three categories get all medical expenses. Whatever they are, you're covered for all medical expenses. There is a cap of 2 years, but possibility for extension of those 2 years based on extenuating circumstances. So you're not capped at 2 years medical expenses, period. In addition, both the temporary impairment and the death, the one that causes death, also get lost wages. Anything that kept you out of work, you are provided 100%. I think in workers' comp it's only 60%. This is 100% of your lost wages for that time that you were left out, kept out of work.
I know you're on a roll here, but there's something I missed at the beginning, and I think it helped me understand as we go through. What's the trigger, you know, in the workman's comp situation? Anybody who's injured, no matter for what reason, is eligible for the comp. I mean, as long as it was job associated. There's no liability fixing. There's no negligence assessment. What triggers the person to fall into this system?
It would be the same trigger that prompts a person to file a medical malpractice claim right now. If they believe something that was done in a medical procedure caused them injury.
And is there an assessment by a board saying whether or not they feel that that's accurate or not?
That's what the board would investigate.
The board would investigate, and then they would recommend whether or not they should be within the system or not.
And it's a hard one, and I grapple with this because it's not, we're comparing it to workers' comp, and the governor calls it no fault. Quite honestly, I'm speaking for myself here, not for the governor. I question how truly can this be a no-fault system. In workers' comp, you are technically saying this was job-related, it was not job-related, period. Which truly is a no-fault.
Right.
You either have it on the
right.
job or didn't. Whose fault
right.
it is doesn't matter. I would argue, and the governor may not let me saying this, but I would argue that you can be 100% no-fault in this system because you're saying it's either medical procedure-related or it's not. Well, it's medical procedure-related. Is there not inherently some sort of fault there? Now, the flip side of that could be, and something that Dr. Conley from Ketchikan explained to me once, I'm not sure, Mary Slater could probably explain this better than I. Doctors evidently use a term, whether it's system, caused by the system or caused by the individual. But there are procedures that physicians or providers use. They are following by rote those procedures, like the prenatal care system, perhaps. Yet, maybe the system is faulted, or maybe there's exceptions to the system that there would be no expectations that a provider would absolutely be aware of those exceptions to the rules. Therefore, you cannot place the blame on that provider that they caused that injury, because that provider didn't follow the system as accurately as he or she possibly could. Does this ring a bell at all?
There was a bad outcome, but it had nothing to do with the following of the procedure.
Right.
Right, medical treatment.
So you could say there's truly no fault there. Then, of course, there's a problem where, yes, that individual was negligent, which is dealt with a little bit differently in this bill. There is true negligence or maliciousness or substance abuse involved, something like that, and that's dealt with separately, which I'll explain. But I think I understand where your snag is, and I have the same snag somewhat, because I'm not really positive how you define no fault in this system.
Yeah. Because it seems to be, ends up just as like a comprehensive welfare act almost.
Well,
got to have some trigger that keeps it from being just a general compensation for
right, and there, and we
all
want
the damage incurred by somebody. And that trigger's got to be somehow that something in the system was wrong. They got wrong somehow in the system that triggers this.
Right. There are provisions that, if we're talking to avoid frivolous claims, et cetera, we want to add some provisions into that, if I can go on.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, so we've got the temporary impairment, which gives you lost wages and medical expenses, the permanent impairment, which gives you medical expenses, and then very much reflects the workers' comp system. We've made the whole person, that whole person term for our new workers' comp bill, worth $1 million. And using the same schedule, American Medical Association guide to blah, 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 figure out what percent of impairment of the whole person you are, you multiply that by 1 million. In workers' comp, it's 135,000, just to compare, we made this 1 million. Death gives you both medical expenses, lost wages, and 1 million flat period. These are not discounted, reduced to present value, these sums. It is a lump sum payment. And it also is a lump sum payment. And subject to subrogation. If you're getting compensation through workers' comp or some other form of insurance, these amounts can all be subrogated. I've given to you, I don't need to read.
What was that last thing you said?
This is all subject to subrogation. They can't be subrogated by other.
So if they had their own life insurance?
I don't think so, Kristen. I think if it falls under a workers' comp claim, where there's, that's probably the best example, that then, if workers' comp was paid, say a job, help me out, Kristen, if I stumble
here. If there was, for instance, a mechanical failure on the respirator in the course of a heart operation, and the person instituted a product liability suit in federal court and made a recovery, there would be a lien against the recovery that they made in federal court against the manufacturer of the failing respirator.
Okay, so the subrogation clause doesn't apply to their own personal insurance?
Doesn't apply to their own personal insurance. Doesn't apply to, although I assume that any personal insurance company would instead coordinate with the this particular statutory insurance, because they do the same with workers' comp. If you get an on-the-job injury, your personal insurance does not pay or recoup the payment. It doesn't. You don't usually get a double recovery if you report everything properly. But this, the way this subrogation would work is if the injured party took a third-party action against, and the one that was most commonly mentioned was a product liability suit, where you would be in federal court and looking at that, because individuals and hospitals and healthcare providers would be protected from.
Ginger, I want to, just before I forget, I want to take a look at personal disability policies and medical policies versus workers' comp and how they interplay. So can you just help me remember that? Yeah. Okay.
One thing that should definitely be noted is there is no payment for pain and suffering. The amounts, the compensation that I just explained for those three different categories are it. There is no pain and suffering compensation. Now, if an injury is aggravated due to negligence, maliciousness, alcohol or substance abuse, there would again be an additional assessment against the provider up to $1 million, and the board determines that amount.
Excuse me. I think the bill provides if it's gross negligence, outrageous conduct, reckless conduct. It's not mere negligence. It's gross recklessness.
Not being an attorney, I forget these.
It's okay.
Come on up, Kristen.
I have to excuse the ladies.
Okay. Oh, no, she's leaving.
She doesn't want to be grossly negligent.
It's defined as a healthcare provider's consumption of alcohol or illegal use of intoxicants or drugs, deliberate and malicious act toward the injured person, or conscious disregard and reckless indifference to the welfare of the injured person. The board shall, blah, blah, blah. And the assessment can be up to $1 million.
That's a higher standard than gross negligence. Yeah.
As I said before, any decision of the board can be appealed to the court.
one thing that we else one other thing we've done with this bill is cap attorney's fees on both sides, the plaintiffs and the defendants. That was something that was talked about and almost joked about in on the workers' comp bill, but we've capped them at 20% of the amount in controversy, and we have to better define that in the bill. What's intended there is the amount in controversy is the difference between the amount that the claimant asked and the defendant or the provider offered, if they offered anything. So if I was asking for $20,000, the provider came in and said, I'll give you $10,000. I said, sorry, I'm not going to settle for that. It goes to the board. The amount in controversy is $10,000. What the most my attorney can make is $2,000. Again, the attempt there is to keep the cost of the system down. And you could, something that we're also grappling with here is, this, will this dissuade attorneys from taking cases? And we want that. If you've got the deep pocket, you've got the attorney on retainer, and you really can't figure out what a 20% cap is because they're on retainer, so how much of his time or her time was put into this one case, so therefore how do you figure 20% was, et cetera, et cetera, it'd be hard to determine. So this could be a downside for the plaintiff. I'm not sure I'm putting that before you as a possibility, but I'm not even sure that I agree with that as a possibility. What I'd like to also, lastly, about the bill itself is call your attention to is the definition of injury, which is found on the last page of the bill, well, beginning of the second last page of the bill, page 12. Injury means a physical or mental injury, disease, or infection proximately caused by an act or omission of a health care provider in the course of treatment sought by or obtained on behalf of the claimant, but does not include probable harmful effects of recognized forms of treatment that are outweighed by the prospective and probable benefits of the treatment and are described by the healthcare provider and consented to by the patient or patient's guardian. So we are considering the normal risk of procedures in this bill. One thing this does not address, and I think we need to, is what happens with the unconscious victim who comes into the emergency room and who does not know what you're doing to that person, and there's got to be an exemption there for that instance. Now, what, if I may continue, we are going to put before you a sponsor substitute for this bill, hopefully by the beginning of session. I'm shooting for the first week of session. And I want to tell you a couple of real big open gaping holes that we want to address, and I still don't have all the answers. We don't have all the answers, but this is what we're looking toward. One we already discussed briefly was some kind of provision for frivolous claims. What we're looking at is having a filing fee by the claimant, a small one, that is subject to being waived if the claimant is indigent. There would be a process in which it could be waived. But something that makes an effort on the part of the claimant to put forth some good faith out of their own pocket that I have a legitimate claim here. The other thing is, in the finding of frivolous claim, is to assess a penalty against the claimant and make them pay any attorney's costs on the part of the provider. So something that would dissuade a frivolous claim. We don't want to see this as you said, Representative Donnelly, a welfare system that people could say, well, heck, if this is no fault system for medical injury, I can go say that my doctor did this to me and I can get some easy money. We don't want to see that happen. I think what may happen under this bill, if this goes into effect, is presumably you could see a decrease in the higher ticket items as far as Med-Mal claims and an increase in the smaller ones. And in talking with the Liability Task Force and the couple of attorneys and the doctors who were there, and I will say the attorneys were not crazy about this bill, the doctors kind of were interested in it, the plaintiff's attorneys, I should say. There's a belief, and Mary can probably also help me out with this, that a lot of folks out there who are injured, but injured in a small way, it's not small to them, but in dollars and cents, it's a small way, are not bothered filing claims because no attorney will take their case. So they have a legitimate $4,000, $5,000 claim. This would solve that. This would give them an ability to get their $4,000 or $5,000. So you may see a readjustment of the dollars. You won't see the $5 million settlements, no. They're few and far between anyway. I don't know if we've had any in. Well, I think there was an $8 million baby case, wasn't there? But those are already few and far between, and no, you won't see those under this. But you will see an avenue for the smaller claims. And you can judge whether that's a good trade-off. The biggest question that we have with this bill is the funding mechanism, and nowhere in this bill is it addressed right now. One thing I did mention it was under the Department of Commerce. We've been weighing this back and forth. How do we fund the system? What we're looking at, and what we will give you some form of an sponsor substitute is an assessment system against all providers. How the formula will work, how we'll write it, how we'll judge what provider pays how much, I don't know. How will this become an alternative to insurance? Will this make a provider no longer have to carry insurance through MICA? Possibly. Maybe that's truly the intent here. I'm not even certain yet. But some sort of assessment that each provider pays into the system to fund it. And like any kind of a risk pool or a pooled insurance, there could probably be an avenue for additional assessments if the pool runs dry. The big problem there is what do you do with the self-insureds, what do you do with the Humanas and the provinces who are part of the national, they're going to scream bloody murder. I offer this to you with all honesty, I don't have the answers, the governor doesn't have the answer, these are things we're working with. We could see ourselves repeat the 1980, was it, lawsuit against MICA that required all docs to carry insurance through MICA, and they successfully fought that.
On that, Mary, jump in on this. The state, there was the lawsuit that says we don't have to get insurance. Did that ever get resolved? Was there ever a court decision on that?
It was settled.
It was settled. And it was settled by the legislature changing the law. I'd be real interested if you could find out what the legal thinking was about that, whether that was a political decision or whether that was a legal, based on a legal decision.
One other thing that we are thinking of doing, that we will do in the sponsor substitute for the funding mechanism, is also assess patients, also assess the users of the system. Maybe we need to take a new approach to all liability, and in this instance we're just talking medical profession, but in the business of insurance is a shared risk concept, and if I am using the services of a provider, the social animal in me perhaps be willing to say, well, I will share the risk of the possible injuries to any user of this system. So maybe I'll pay 50 cents, maybe I'll pay 75 cents, maybe I'll pay $2 per visit. We haven't set the figure yet. We want to keep it low. There's probably going to need to be a mechanism for the welfare user, somebody who can't afford to pay that added assessment, because it could affect Medicaid and Medicare and all those other things, and now you're tacking on an extra 50 cents or a dollar every time a person uses the system. But the concept we want to get across is that, yes, you will pay something every time you use a provider, so that we do share in the cost. And the last question that we need to address is there is no mechanism for comparative fault in this bill. I don't know the no-fault auto insurance system well, but as I understand it, even in no-fault auto insurance, as we have it written in the state, there is some ability to consider comparative fault, the potential negligence of each driver. That's not mentioned here, and perhaps it needs to be. It's something we need to address in the next few weeks. With that, I will close just to reiterate again that this is not yet perfect, and whether this can work, we don't know. Nobody else has tried it exactly in this way. But we have a problem, and the governor felt this was the best approach that he could think of to try to address the problem and keep it as equitable to all parties as possible.
Questions? Representative Lehman?
Sure, the last time I sat through your explanation was on the Liability Insurance Task Force. And I appreciate your candor and the governor's in saying that it's not yet perfect. And I'd suggest there's probably lots of legislation that we pass is not yet perfect. But have you made progress toward perfection in that, you know, since last May when this was submitted? Are we making some progress, or do you expect us to, and I, you know, you're addressing some of those questions, or do you expect us through the hearing process, you know, in the bill and the legislature to be bringing it to perfection?
We've made real slow progress, and at this point, I think our biggest, the most amount of our progress has been citing where the problems are. We have a couple of solutions. We don't have solutions in the biggies, and the biggest thing to me is the funding mechanism. I would say what we're hoping to do is work jointly. We'll put a sponsor substitute before you in 4 or 5 weeks that will try to close up a lot of these gaps. I'm not going to promise that sponsor substitute is going to be perfect either. I think that at that point we'll still need to work with the committee.
There are some pretty radical changes proposed here, and you know, there's impacts lots of people and in a big way. And you know, I'm wondering if we're going to be able to even address this in this next session. You know, something, I hope you don't mind me saying, it's radical, but I'm not saying necessarily that all radical ideas are bad. Sometimes I think we need to have radical ideas proposed to get us thinking.
I would agree with you, and I would love to see this bill be able to get through in one session, because I work for the governor and it's his bill, and that's what he would like. I'm going to be very candid, having been around the legislature a few years, and know that an idea such as this would be very difficult to get through in one session. I think, if nothing else, even if, you know, if the governor, I don't know if his heart of hearts what he believes the possibility of getting through in 1 year is. I think, though, to avoid discussion of this and avoid trying to perfect this under the belief that it cannot get through in one session would be a mistake. Because I think it is a concept whose perhaps time has come, and if it doesn't happen this session, it's on the table, and there's some knowledge of this concept that can be carried forward into the 17th legislature, hopefully, and perhaps go forward within that legislature or the one after that one. A lot of radical ideas take 4, 5, 6 years to get through the legislature. I think it'd be a mistake to not begin now.
Would you say that this is a priority of the governor?
I would say it is.
I'll be listening when he gives the State of the State address to see if there's a reference to this, to see where he places it.
May I address that? I have not, he hasn't read it yet, so I haven't read it yet, but I will tell you, don't look for it. the governor's State of the State will most likely center around education. Don't quote me, I'm not sure.
Well, I've heard that one already, so maybe I'll stay home that evening.
We did just discuss this with the governor on Tuesday. We had a staff retreat, and there's no doubt the education issues, especially education fund, are his priority. But this comes up there, too.
Well, I'd suggest, if it is a priority, that he identify it as such. And you might pass that comment on it.
I will do so.
I
looked at the bill, and I think it does have a lot of problems, but I do think that there is merit to the bill. And when I first went to the legislature, I was working on a similar draft to try to put together a system that gets the money to the injured person faster and puts most of the money into the victim's pocket as opposed to everybody else's pocket. And my experience as a rehabilitation person is that when you look at these big $3.5 million claims or settlements, that a very small percentage of that $3.5 million actually goes to the injured person. And I'm in a situation where I write life care plans for people who've had a catastrophic injury, and I'll put together a life care plan that is used to settle a case. And the life care plans run anywhere from $1 million to $5 million, depending on the degree of injury. And it's very frustrating to me that when I put a plan together, I've identified in that plan everything that I think that person is going to need as a result of their injury. And when the case is actually settled, is I know that that person needs $3.5 million to take care of themselves for the rest of their life. And the case settles for maybe $4 million, and they don't wind up with $3.5 million in their pocket to take care of themselves for the rest of their life. So I think there's real merit in any bill that would attempt to assure that most of that money really goes to the victim, and I would say in that since I really commend the bill. One of the other concerns that I've had about our tort system is that the degree to which the injured party is compensated has nothing to do with the degree to which the person has been injured, and that you'll find somebody who's a C4 quadriplegic who will never work again and never be able to do anything again, and unfortunately the person who injured him or her had the $500,000 limit on their policy, and they wind up getting very little money, certainly not enough to benefit them. But you have somebody who has a back sprain, and the person who injured them is somebody who has millions of dollars, and they wind up getting 3 and 4 and 5 times what the quadriplegic got because they were lucky enough to be injured by somebody who had a lot of resources and a lot of assets. So I think any bill that would attempt to fix that, you know, in the system, I think has a lot of merit. And that would be the question that I would have in looking at the structure, that it seems that that is part of the intent of the bill, that the individual is compensated based on the degree of injury. If they have a big injury, they'll get the max. If they have a little injury, they maybe not get as much, but there's direct correlation. The other question I had was, you said that you would cap attorney's fees on both sides, the 25% of the amount. 20% of the amount between what was offered, say, by the defendant and what was counteroffered. I think it might be fairer, instead of doing that, if you had a claimant who a plaintiff who said, you know, they put in a claim for maybe $500,000, and the insured or the defendant comes back and says, no, we're going to only give you $10,000. It would seem to me that rather than using just those figures, that the board would make a determination in terms of what is fair, and that 25% would be premised perhaps on what the fair amount is, as opposed to what people think it is. That, you know, because some insurance companies do make an assessment and are pretty right on when they make their counteroffer, and some of them don't. Some of them just kind of ballpark it. So you might perhaps have in the board some mechanism to assess the value of a claim, so that if an insured has made an unrealistic demand, that you know that, and not only know it, but penalize them for it. And you might penalize them by maybe increasing their share of the cost or something to that effect. So, because that would be something that I would see, is that, okay. With regard to funding, your purpose was to assess the users of the system, so that if somebody doesn't use the system, then they're not going to be assessed for it. That would seem to me that if you're going to do that, if you really truly want a no-fault system, you want everybody covered, or you want everybody protected, but yet you're going to be charging the users of the system, so that if you have, you know, 500,000 people in the state, they're all going to benefit by the bill, potentially benefit, and that assurance is that they're going to be compensated if something happens to them, or they're going to be able to utilize this mechanism, but actually only the people who use the system are going to use it. I don't see how you're going to be able to fund it to any degree by assessing the users of the system.
May I respond to the chair? I'm not sure I follow, because if you've been injured and therefore use the system of compensation, you've used the system, the medical system, too. That's the way you got injured, presumably. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you have paid your user's fee into the system. Mm-hmm. I mean, your injury is going to be the result of having gone to the doctor, having gone to the hospital, having gone to the nurse practitioner, whomever. Mm-hmm. And you've paid your 50 cents, your $1, your $2 off for that visit.
Mm-hmm. So what I'm saying, when you use that kind of a mechanism, that means that everybody who's going to a doctor is paying that.
Correct.
Right. And that's what your intention is.
Correct.
So not everyone then who is going to a doctor is going to have to utilize the system. Only those people who become injured are going to be utilizing the system.
Right, but that's the nature.
So in a sense, all the people accessing the service are going to be charged a fee.
Correct. And if I may continue, and I probably am getting redundant with what I said before, but the premise behind that being that we share the risk in this society, and that's what insurance is doing too. I mean, I've never put in a claim to my auto insurance in however many years I've driven a car, but I'm paying for somebody else's claims in a sense. So that's the nature of insurance, and in a shared risk system, which we're saying this needs to be.
So the assessment then would not be a punitive one, in that it would be directly assessed against the person using the system, but it would be an assessment that's made of everybody who's using the service, and that's
correct.
What I want to make clear.
And maybe the assessment in the assessment would be the correct term in terms of the providers paying the system, because there truly would be an assessment based on the amount of business you do or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
For the patient, the user of the system, and by now I'm meaning the medical system, not the claims system, but the medical system. Perhaps fee is the better.
Mm-hmm. You use assessment.
It'd be a set, yeah, and it'd be a set fee. You wouldn't pay more than I would. We'd pay the same amount.
So we'd all pay an extra 50 cents?
And whatever we'd set it to be.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am. Could you state your name first?
My name is Nancy Horn. And I apologize for not being here earlier, but I have a question on the 50 cent fee. If I were working in a doctor's office and I charged the patient who came in 50 cents coming into the doctor for that, would it be a situation where I collect from the patient, I bill the insurance that they have for the 50 cents, or I, as the doctor's office, pay 50 cents?
No, the doctor's office wouldn't pay it because the doctor is already being assessed as a provider. They're already paying into the system.
He's paying 50 cents.
The patient.
For your 50 cents.
No, he's probably paying a lot more than 50
okay.
cents.
Oh, okay. So he's in the system. Now, where does
right.
the 50 cents actually come from?
That would probably be up to the carrier, that individual person. I'm not sure yet whether that would come out of pocket and would not be covered by insurance. Or if insurance, be it whoever is your carrier, would cover that fee. I don't know. And I think that the individual carriers would have to make that decision. And I could see them saying, forget it, we're not going to cover it.
What if the injured person is indigent? We
recognize that could be a problem. There would be some kind of mechanism to waive the fee for indigency.
Okay. Thanks. Is there any other questions? Well, Sherry, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you for inviting
appreciate
me.
It. Sorry I couldn't be at the liability.
So for the same spiel.
Yeah. I sure understand the proposal better than I ever did before. So you think the sponsor substitute will be in January?
Yes, we're going to shoot for some session.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'll probably be calling Ginger Law between now and then.
Okay. All right, thanks. I don't have anybody else lined up to testify today. Mary, really glad you could come back today. Really appreciate it. I learned a lot. And unless somebody else had something they wanted to bring before the committee, we'll wrap it up.